Welcome to the Pedal Revolutionary Show. As you all know by now, the revolution will not be motorized. You're listening to 101.9 FM CITR. Out here at UBC, it's a beautiful sunshine day. Please wear sunscreen and drink lots of water, or otherwise take care of yourselves, because you must survive until the revolution arrives. My name is Ifni. I'm going to be your host today, as I am every couple of weeks, and we are going to have a show celebrating sweaty labor solidarity. We're all kind of squeezed into the studio today. We have lots and lots of bodies that you can't see, but if you can imagine knees touching... Oh, here, we have to close the door behind me. Thank you. Okay. So we've been away for a little while. We had a show swap that we did, so we're back to visit you, and David's here in the studio. We also have, all the way from Portland, USA, the wonderful Richard Seymour of the Free Geek Portland. He is also a wobbly. And if you know what a wobbly is, call in and say hello. Or if you yourself are a wobbly or a lover of wobblies, the number here in the studio is 604-UBC-CITR. We're also being joined by a very bearded fellow, one of our favorite people who's been on the show before, Rowan Lipkowitz of the Creaking Planks. There he is. He's just got enough room to move his fingers and squeeze his bellows. So he'll be playing a little bit later on. And we're also, we have a wonderful surprise visit, someone who has not been on our show before, but has been on many, many radio shows, and certainly talked a lot of trash this fine country over. We have Joey Only is in the studio with us today, so he's going to be playing a little bit later on as well. Now, Labor Day is coming up. As you know, Labor Day, that fine underrepresented holiday, that actually was an invention of Canada, just like baseball. So you may or may not know this, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. But for now, let's play a little song. Actually, you know what? Heck, I'll tell you right now so you can think about this as we play this song. I'll read you a passage that I found on the internets. The Canadian labor movement can justly claim the title of the originator of Labor Day. Earliest records show that the Toronto Trades Assembly, perhaps the original central labor body in Canada, organized the first North American, quote-unquote, working man's demonstration of any significance for April the 15th, 1872. There was a parade out in Toronto. There were about 10,000 citizens who turned out to see the parade and listen to speeches calling for abolition of the law, which decreed that trade unions were criminal conspiracies in restraint of trade. At the time, there were actually 24 imprisoned leaders of the Toronto Typographical Union. They were on strike. They were trying to secure the nine-hour working day. Wow. Boy, they were shooting high. They were going for the nine-hour working day, and that was the immediate purpose of the parade. This was actually when Thanksgiving Day was in the spring, so that was Thanksgiving Day back in 1872. At that time, it was still a crime to be a member of a union in Canada, although a year before it had been actually legalized in the UK. And actually, that same year, Toronto wasn't the only city that had a labor parade. Also on September 3rd, members of seven unions in Ottawa organized a parade more than a mile long, which was headed by the Garrison Artillery Band and flanked by city firemen carrying torches. I love this stuff. This is so picturesque. This is where the parade went. They wound their way to the home of our former Prime Minister, John A. Macdonald, love him or hate him. Someone hates him. Boy,
racist.
You hold your grudge. Yeah, well, you know, it's fair enough. But this is what I love about these days. They went to his house and they actually hoisted him into a carriage. They went to the Prime Minister's house. They picked him up and they put him in a carriage. And they took him to City Hall by torchlight. On the steps of City Hall, they must have dragged him out of the carriage, and he stood up and said that he promised that the marchers, he promised to the marchers that his party would sweep away, quote unquote, all such barbarous laws from the statute books. So, later that year, indeed, labor conspiracy laws were repealed. Indeed, a mixed legacy for good old Sir John A. Anyway, in that same year, in 1882, my mistake, the Toronto Trades and Labor Council actually wanted to have a picnic and annual demonstration. And they invited a gentleman named Peter J. McGuire from the States, from New York, who is one of the founders of the American Federation of Labor, and they asked him to speak. And from there, Peter McGuire went back to the States and thought, you know what, this annual thing really rocks. So they started to have this in New York as well, starting September the 5th, 1882. And here we are. We're getting close to Labor Day. And what do people usually do on Labor Day? They have barbecues, they have picnics, they have all these things. But really what we should also be trying to remember is that this is a day that a lot of people were imprisoned. This is what we need to remember on this day, as well as having a picnic and enjoying our free leisure time with our loved ones. Anyway, I'd like us to play a song, and this is actually dedicated to the Wobblies and to Richard, because I know he's a big fan of Mr. Block. So this is a gentleman who unfortunately recently passed away. What's that?
You're stealing my material.
Oh, well, you know what? Every version of Mr. Block is a different version. So Mr. Block has many shapes. So here we are listening to Mr. Block by the wonderful and recently deceased Utah Phillips.
Oh, Mr. Block, you were born by mistake. You take the cake, you make me ache. Go tie a rock on your block and go jump in the lake. Kindly do that for liberty's sake. Now that you can go quack or, you know, whatever you want. Just whatever nice, gross sound you feel like making, you can flatulate. Well, I've practiced that chorus. Oh, Mr. Block, you are. This isn't this wonderful poetry. I mean, Ogden Nash would blush. Oh, Mr. Block, you were born by mistake. You take the cake. You make me ache. Tie a rock on your block and then jump in the lake. Kindly do that for liberty's sake. Oh, Mr. Block, you were born by mistake. You take the cake. You make me ache. Go tie a rock on your block and go jump in the lake. Kindly do that for liberty's sake. Yeah, what I hear in here, maybe John, do you hear this? Oh, Mr. Block, you were born by mistake. Da da da, you take the cake. Ba da da, you take.
Maybe. You ever thought of it? Kazoo. No. Please give me your attention. I'll introduce to you a man that is a credit, our red, white, and blue. His head is made of lumber and solid as a rock. He is a common worker, and his name is Mr. Block. And Block, he thinks he may be president someday. Oh, Mr. Block, you were born by mistake. You take the cake. You make me ache. Go tie a rock on your block and go jump in the lake. Kindly do that for liberty's sake. Yes, Mr. Block is lucky. Found a job by G. The shark got $7 for job and fare and fee. They shipped him to a desert and dumped him with his truck. But when he tried to find his job, he sure was out of luck. He shouted, "That's too raw. I'll fix him with the law." Oh, Mr. Block, you were born by mistake. You take the cake. You make me ache. Go tie a rock on your block and go jump in the lake. Kindly do that for liberty's sake. Oh, Block hiked back to the city, but wasn't doing well. He said, "I'll join the union, the great AF of L." He got a job next morning, got fired in the night. He said, "I'll see McDermott and he'll fix that foreman right." McDermott said, "You see, you've got our sympathy. Oh, Mr. Block, you were born by mistake. You take the cake, you make me ache. Go tie a rock on your block and go jump in the lake. Kindly do that for liberty's sake." Election day he shouted, "A socialist for mayor." The comrade got elected, he happy was for fair. But after the election he got an awful shock. A great big socialistic bull did rap him on the block. And comrade Block did sob, "I helped him get his job." Oh, Mr. Block, you were born by mistake. You take the cake, you make me ache. Go tie a rock on your block and go jump in the lake. Kindly do that for liberty's sake. Poor Block, he died one evening, I'm very glad to state. He climbed the golden ladder up to the pearly gate. He said, "Oh, Mr. Peter, one word I'd like to tell. I'd like to meet the Astor Bills and John D. Rockefeller." Old Pete said, "Is that so? You'll meet them down below." Oh, Mr. Block, you were born by mistake. You take the cake, you make me ache. Go tie a rock on your block and go jump in the lake. Kindly do that for liberty's sake.
Well, howdy there, pedal revolutionaries. My name is Joey Only, and I have one of my bandmates here in the studio with me, Mr. Rowan Lipkowitz,
who
also plays in the Creaking Planks. But he's also in my band. Haha. Anyway, so we're talking about Labor Day and all that kind of stuff today. And most of you probably don't know me or what I do, and you probably don't know what the IWW is, or what a Wobbly is, or what the Industrial Workers of the World is. Well, surprise, they're all the same thing, and I'm going to tell you about this event that happened in history in Chicago in 1905, when many folks from all sorts of different radical backgrounds and union backgrounds come together, and they decided on a constitution for a workers union, for one big union, for a union that would not service just one sector of the industry, but would represent all workers across the board. And they formed the Industrial Workers of the World. And they agreed on a constitution. The preamble starts off like this. I won't read you the whole thing, but the preamble says, "The working class and the ruling class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found amongst millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things in life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers would organize as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth." And that's what the IWW does. So years went on, and there was a lot of heavy strikes going on in the States back then, and also up here in the North. And I can't obviously get into all of them, but to make a long story short, there is a lot of them. If there was to be some or many, that wouldn't be the same as being a lot. There are a lot of strikes going on, big movements, big organization, and people really believing that the revolution was just around the corner. And perhaps if we had that same feeling today, things would go a little better. So what I'm going to jump into right now, though, is the story of Joe Hill. And Joe Hill was Josef Hillström come over from Sweden and got involved with the IWW and decided to become their folk singer and began writing a lot of songs. And he wasn't the only one doing it, but he's the one who in history is remembered the most. And they had a free speech campaign that was happening. And all through the American West, the comrades would get together in big meetings, and eventually someone would put out a soapbox and stand on the soapbox and say, "Comrades," or "Brothers and sisters," or something to the effect. And the cops would haul him off because free speech wasn't a right back then and still isn't now, you could argue. And then the next person would take his place, "Comrades," and the cops would grab him, and "Comrades," a third person, "Comrades," a fourth person, and eventually the jail was full of 150 people. Well, this strategy wasn't working too well for the cops to shut down dissent. Well, who came along but the Starvation Army, the wonderful, benevolent group of Christians who are out to help the poor, so they would have you believe. Whether they've actually ever done that or not, I'm not sure. And what the Salvation Army would do is they had their big trombones and trumpets and all this nonsense, and they'd start playing hymns at the IWW rallies in cities all over the West. And when they played their hymns, they would drown out, of course, the day was before sound systems and speakers. They would drown out the speaker. Well, Joe Hill came up with an idea. He began to rewrite all of their Christian songs. And change them. So in the Sweet By and By, when they came out one day to play in the Sweet By and By, well, suddenly Joe Hill's version was the preacher and the slave, and they pulled out their little songbooks they had and began to sing the preacher and the slave. One. Feel free to sing along in your living room. Long-haired preachers come out every night, try to tell you what's wrong and what's right. When you ask them about something to eat, they will tell you in voices so sweet, You will eat by and by,
by and by,
in that glorious land in the sky,
whereby
work and pray and live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die, that's a lie. At the Starvation Army they pray, and they sing, and they clap, and they pray, and they tell you put your coin on the drum, and they tell you that you are on the bum. You'll eat,
you'll eat,
by and by,
by and by,
in that glorious land in the sky,
way up high.
You get pie in the sky when you die, that's life. If you fight for the good things in life, side by side for freedom we will fight. Or be a sheep for the bosses as they say, and to hell you will sing out their refrain. You'll eat,
you'll eat,
by and by,
by and by,
in that glorious land in the sky,
whereby
working well and all day. You'll get pie in the sky when you die, that's a lie. You'll eat by and by,
by and by,
in that glorious land in the sky,
where pie
working friend on hay. Hey, you'll get pie in the sky when you die, that's a lie. You'll get pie in the sky when you die, that's a lie. You'll get pie in the sky when you die, that's a lie.
Just turn off.
So, thank you, listeners out there in Radio Land, very much. You know, it is kind of redundant that we're on the air singing on the bicycle show after just driving 8,000 kilometers worth of tour this summer, but that's what the Outlaw Band does. You can come see our Outlaw Band. We're going to be with Bob Wayne and the Outlaw Carnies down at Café du Soleil on Friday the 29th of this month. And Bob Wayne's great. He tours with Hank Williams III and crazy acts like that, David Allan Coe. So we're very lucky to get a couple weeks with him. We were singing about Joe Hill, and you heard Utah Phillips a little earlier singing the song Mr. Block. And it was kind of out of context because you probably didn't realize that Mr. Block song was not a Utah Phillips song at all, but it was a Joe Hill song. And Joe Hill wrote that because Mr. Block, well, if you listen to the words, Mr. Block's rather naive. He tends to believe that that there's hope in the system. He thinks that he can be president someday, but also he thinks that the trade unions are looking after his best interest. He believes that having a socialist government will make his life better. But in the end, the trade union dumps him, and he's got no work. And when he gets in the socialist for mayor, a comrade cop comes and raps him on his block. And in the end, comrade Block goes to heaven. I'm very sad to state, he climbed the golden ladder up to the pearly gate. He said, oh, Mr. Peter, one word I'd like to tell. I want to meet the Astor Bilts and John D. Rockefeller. Oh, Peter says, is that so? You'll see them down below, fool. So that's the story of Mr. Block you heard a little earlier. I don't have to recreate the whole song now because that's been done. But the story of Joe Hill, nonetheless, he carries on. It was in the day of November 19th, 1915, when Joe Hill met his untimely fate. And I wanted to read you something from his will. Now, what happened was Joe Hill was very involved in the state of Utah and the mining campaigns and striking, organizing workers up there. And one day, some boss on the line got dead, and everyone said it was Joe Hill that pulled the trigger. And on the day of November 19th, 1915, he was shot by a firing squad in the state of Utah, of course, but Salt Lake City. But he does have this will that's in this book called The Little Red Songbook, which I'm going to tell you a little bit about. These are where we're getting today's songs from. These are not I can't take no credit for them. These are IWW songs through and through. But this is no song. It's the only thing in the book that's not a song. It's Joe Hill's last will. He says, my will is easy to decide, for there is nothing to divide. My kin don't need to fuss and moan. Moss don't cling to a rolling stone. My body, if I could choose, I would to ashes it reduce, and let the merry breezes blow, my dust to where some flowers grow. Perhaps the fleeting flower then would come to life and bloom again. This is my last and final will. Good luck to all of you. Joe Hill. Heavy stuff, eh? So, I shouldn't bump the mics. Terrible of me. Where are we here? I'm looking for one more Joe Hill song. That's great. It first appeared... Oh, it's not a Joe Hill song. Well, let's not sing that one.
After all that setup.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's not a Joe Hill song. It's John Brill. I guess I just never looked at the words very closely. But I looked at the date, and it said 1916. I just got done telling you that Joe Hill was killed in 1915. I thought, I better look at the name again.
He's like Tupac.
Yeah. He just keeps releasing albums, eh? Well, let's try this one anyways. It's great. Here's another Christian song converted to radical song. It's called Dump the Bosses Off Your Back, and we used to sing it in church as Take It to the Lord in Prayer, which growing up I sang many times in church. But it goes...
Are you cold, forlorn, and hungry? And are there lots of things you lack? Is your life made up of misery? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are your clothes all torn and tattered? And are you living in a shack? Would you have your troubles scattered? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are you almost split asunder? Loaded like a long-eared jack? Boob, why don't you buck like thunder? And dump the bosses off your back. agony you suffer. You could end with one big whack. So stiffen up, you ornery duffer, and dump the bosses off your back. Dump the bosses off your back. Dump the bosses off your back.
I'm trying to get these words out with the cold. Sometimes it's hard. Not a lot of room in my lungs with all that fluid today, but no more complaining. Another one, we used to have the doxology in church, which when you'd bring the collection plate up, you'd sing this certain song. But the Wobblies have it in here, written by an Australian Wobbly. It says, praise boss when morning work bells chime. Praise him for chunks of overtime. Praise him whose bloody wars we fight. Praise him, fat leech and parasite. Ah, hell. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that great? Oh, there's so many good songs. So this is the Little Red Songbook I have, and it's a book that the industrial workers of the world update regularly. I believe there's over 40 editions now, including a Canadian edition, which has a lot of songs by a good friend of ours from Toronto named Smokey Dimney. And he's got one thing that Smokey got to do. If you knew Utah Phillips really well, there's nothing he here's a Smokey song, General Strike. One thing Utah really liked was when you took one of his songs and made it better. And that's the kind of folk music he was from. He would say, I don't own a song because what I'm writing about is experiences that I see others living out. So how can I claim responsibility for creating poetry out of their successes and failures? And I think that's very true. So Smokey wrote his own version to a Utah Phillips song called Larimer Street. And one of the reasons why I think it's good to sing this song today is because with the gentrification happening in the downtown east side and elsewhere around Vancouver, it's pretty relevant. The song's about Larimer Street, which is a street in a city of Denver, Colorado. And it's much like the downtown east side. And he wrote this song for it. Your bulldozer's rolling through my part of town. The iron ball swings, knocks it all down. Well, you knocked down the flop house and you knocked down the bars and you flat-topped it over to park all your cars. And where will I go? Where can I stay? Well, you knocked down the skid row and you hauled it away. I'll flag it fast rather than ride it on down, boys. They're running the bums out of town. Maxie the tailor, he's closing his doors, and there ain't nothing left in his secondhand stores. Well, you knock down the pawn shop in the old Harbor Light and the old Chinese cafe that was open all night. And where can I go? And where can I stay? Well, you knocked down the skid row and you hauled it away. I'll drag it fast rather than ride it on down, boys. They're running the bums out of town. Well, you ran at the hookers who worked on the street just to build a big hall where the playboys can meet. My bookie joint closed when your cops pulled a raid, but you built a big hall for the stock market trade. And where can I go? And where can I stay? Well, you knocked down the skid row and you hauled it away. I'll flag it fast rather than ride it on down, boys. They're running the bums out of town. So in the Canadian version, Smokey Dimney's verse appears. The small town businesses don't stand a chance with the big uptown bankers a calling the dance. With the suit and tie restaurants all owned by Greeks, with the counterfeit hippies and their plastic boutiques. And where can I go? And where can I stay? Well, you knocked down the skid row and you hauled it away. Well, flag it fast rather than ride it on down, boys. They're
running the bums out of town. Now I'm finding out there's just one kind of whore. It's the one going on between the rich and the poor. Yeah, I don't know a lot about what you all would call class, but the upper and the middle, they can all kiss my ass. And where can I go? And where can I stay? Well, you knocked down the skid row and you hauled it away. I'll flag it fast rather than ride it on down, boys. They're running the bums, yeah, they're running the bums. They're running the bums out of town.
Wow. Wow. That was great. And it was good that you explained what the Wobblies were, because we didn't get anybody calling in to tell us what they thought they were or to say hello to them.
The word wobbly actually originated from Vancouver. And surprisingly enough, it's a worldwide term. But apparently a bunch of wobs used to meet in this Chinese cafe. And for some reason, because of the owner's accent or whatever have you, whenever he went to say IWW, he'd say I wobbly wobbly or something like that. And they actually got the nickname Wobbly here in Vancouver sometime about 80, 90 years ago. At least that's the rumor.
That's one of the rumors. Do you know any of the other rumors there, Richard? Have you heard?
There
Whichever
are a lot.
One you want.
Which one?
Here, how about this one? How about this one?
Here.
Share with me. And then Rowan
there
can talk to us,
There are a lot of
too.
Rumors. That's one of them. That's the one I think that's most popular. There's no definitive answer. Nobody actually knows. But, hey, I just wanted to, you know, chime in, because I think this this threat of Joe Hill and, unfortunately, Utah Phillips is passing this last year, actually all continues to play out. And I don't know if you know this or not, but Joe Hill was cremated. And his ashes were split up and sent all around the world to all the different general membership branches and all the different branches of the IWW all around the world, where they were scattered into the wind. And after that, a lot of people thought that the IWW died out. And if you actually go and you look in history books, and maybe this is the reason people aren't calling in, you'll see some labor history books that say that the Wobblies died out in 1920-something, 1930-something. Different dates.
35 often, I hear.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was a chair of the general executive board of the IWW just last year, and I was at their centenary in Chicago, where that little red songbook you're holding there came from, 3 years ago. So I can tell you we haven't gone away. We're not, contrary to what your labor history books might say. But one thing that did happen is there were a lot of raids against the IWW in the 20s, in the 30s. And in that time, the FBI took possession of a lot of documents of the IWW. And a very interesting thing happened later on that involves Utah Phillips, which is that we filed a Freedom of Information Act against the FBI, and, you know, to get, you know, what kind of documents do you have on our organization? And lo and behold, one of the documents that came out indicated that they still had a vial of confiscated Joe Hill ashes. And we sent Utah Phillips to Washington, D.C., to the FBI to pick those ashes up. And he took them, and we redistributed them amongst all the existing branches and scattered them around. So the story continues on. and continues on.
That sure beats Sid Vicious having his ashes scattered in the ventilation duct at Heathrow Airport. People are breathing in Sid Vicious.
Yeah. But I also wanted to point out that Mr. Block was an incredibly brilliant cartoon before it was a Joe Hill song. Joe Hill was reading the cartoon that was written by Ernest Reeb, who was a Wobbly, a German immigrant who came in, lived in Minneapolis, I think may have lived in Idaho for a while. And he drew these incredibly brilliant little cartoons about a guy with a square head. And those were collected together in a collection that's probably the first actual underground comic book ever produced in North America. Mr. Block lives on, and actually I was the cartoonist for Mr. Block the last couple years in the Industrial Worker.
What's the Industrial Worker?
The Industrial Worker is the newspaper of the IWW.
And they even have a website. They have all this stuff. They're totally alive.
And you can go to IWW.org and find it.
Or I Wobble Wobble.
Or I Wobble Wobble.
One thing I know you mentioned free speech and how some of the strategies I think that the IWW has employed and continues to promote as being effective are interesting, and you can see a lot of that stuff on their website. But back in the day, they used to hide in a doorway. Before this trick got old, they would hide in a doorway with one member dressed in a bowler hat and carrying a briefcase and an umbrella, who would yell to the crowd, "Help, help, I've been robbed, I've been robbed." And the crowd would kind of rush over to help, and he would say, "I've been robbed by the capitalist system. Follow," you know, and good launch into a speech addressed to his fellow workers. So kind of that gave me a little bit of a laugh. I'd like to maybe go into talking to you, Richard, if we can. I know we haven't heard a peep out of Richard Rowan. Rowan, will you peep for us?
Beep.
Thank you. And would you mind sharing your mic with Richard? Wonderful. It's sweaty solidarity here on 101.9 FM today on the Pedal Revolutionary Show. There we go. So, Richard, let's talk a little bit about how, well, for one thing, I don't know, how did your labor consciousness begin? Did it begin in the womb after?
I think I inherited it. My grandfather was a union organizer, and his father was a union organizer, and I think my parents' generation got hit by McCarthyism, and it didn't pass into that generation very well. But I grew up sort of wanting to agitate, you might say. Opportunity didn't present itself to me until much later, but I got involved with the IWW about the same time that I got involved with Free Geek in Portland. I had encounters with the IWW when I lived in Minneapolis back in the 80s, and a lot of musicians, great musicians, some of whom were at the centenary celebration in Chicago, were very strong, and so I had a lot of dealings with the IWW back then, but I didn't have an opportunity to join because there was really nothing I could plug into for my work, actual work, any kind of a workplace struggle that I had. This is one of the disadvantages of working in worker-controlled co-ops is you don't have any boss to fight, you know, so you can't, it's hard to get a handle on joining, why you'd want to join the IWW.
And but, connect with your rage, right?
Yeah, and connect with your rage, yeah. But anyway, I finally did it when I moved back to Portland, which is where I'm from, and started organizing people who were working with computer workers, you know, basically working with folks who were doing software programming and that sort of thing. And we ended up finding one guy who had a shop of computer programmers that were, you know, they were allegedly producing code. The boss in this case was really just a con man who was basically taking the money, not paying the workers, taking the money from the customers, pretending that he was working, faxing stuff back and forth, kiting checks. This man was a real piece of work. We ended up going through his garbage. We ended up putting up a website about him and basically getting him to the point where he could no longer operate in the city of Portland under his name. And we ended up taking 17 Wobblies down to his place of business and having a conversation with him about how he should be paying his workers. And he pulled $500 out of his pocket that day and gave it to one of the workers. And that's the last time we ever saw any money from him, even though we filed with the Bureau of Labor and Industries and went through all the other routines that you're supposed to go through. But in the end, you know, it's like lots and lots of people ended up not getting paid because of him. But the IWW was able to extract a small amount of money. The organization is also working a lot. There's like you hear about the Starbucks workers are organizing. That's all IWW mostly. There's a lot of restaurant workers. There's a lot of truckers and there's just a wide. This is one of the things is that it's a union that has probably 2,000 members worldwide, mostly in the U.S., Canada, and in the British Isles. At this point, the British Isles is growing phenomenally, and one of the interesting things is our very first international assembly, which we have every year, the very first one that's going to be happening in the last 105 years, last 103 years, this is the first one that is going to be happening off the continent. It's going to be happening in London this Labor Day.
Exciting. Yeah. So if people want to get involved with the IWW, what would you guys suggest they do?
I would go.
I mean, in Vancouver, we have a branch, which I'm a member of. It's Joey here speaking. Mm-hmm. And maybe the best thing you can do is contact someone from the branch. Maybe you could contact me, info@joeyonly.com.
Okay.
And I can put you in touch with the right people.
And do you get, like, a little card?
You do get that kind of stuff. I mean, that's all nice, and the a lot of the Wobbly merch is nice, and I like it. But there is... to me, the IWW still lives on, whether or not it's in the name of the IWW. And I think good examples of that happen with organizations that I used to be involved with a thing called the Ontario Common Front, and we organized with a group called the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty a lot, and we were a provincial network of anti-poverty fighters who basically, the basis of unity, although not the same sentences and same words, amounted and affected to the exact same culture that the IWW historically has had. So, I mean, you don't have to have a card that says IWW on it to be basically living the same thing. You just have to fight.
Nice. What do you think is really important for people listening out there to know about solidarity and what collectivizing can do for them and what they should really be worried about? What do you think they should be worried about right now?
Well, that's a tough one. I'm mighty concerned about the apocalypse. So, I mean, a lot of the smaller issues. Someone wrote me today saying how they wanted to get the Storium made. Audrey LaFerrier, downtown Eastside activist of sorts, wants to get the Storium turned into a shelter. And she said that the other anti-poverty groups are resisting it because they want social housing, not shelters. And there's this dichotomy whether or not you want social housing or shelters. And I just scratch my head thinking that the fucking apocalypse is here. I mean, whatever you can get for somebody, the better. I mean, I don't know if I want a shelter or a house. I mean, personally, I want a mansion in the sky. But I'm not going to get that. Anything would do. I mean, if you're passionate about something, don't sell that short. Don't think that you're foolish. I think Audrey's been discouraged a lot by people because she's got this vision of having Storium turned into a shelter. I don't think that's something she should be discouraged about. It just sometimes takes a while to see your vision, to find people who will sign on to that.
What about you, Richard?
I'd say the most important thing for people to do is talk to the people you work with about stuff that matters to you and matters to them, and really listen to them. Even if they don't seem to be the most radical person on the planet, you and them have something in common. And what you have in common, if nothing else, what we almost all of us have in common is that we are all working in a big machine that's controlled by a smaller number of people, and we are being pitted against each other. And if you work and talk with people who you work with about what matters to them, you will start to figure out how to organize yourselves so you can resist that.
I love that response, actually. I really do. I think the big failure of the left is... that we create divisions between who is left and who is not and who is right. And if someone doesn't agree with you 100%, you shit-talk them and write them off. And I know, like, for our band, the Outlaw Band, we don't preach anarchism a whole lot on stage. It's not really what we do. But what we do try to do is promote radical culture and promote freedom. And what I see often is because we do have, as a country band, some kind of... We have our ear to the ground with the average working-class person wherever we go. And whether or not we can talk about, personally, I could talk about weather or ranching, I could talk about hockey, I could talk about fishing, hunting, and I could talk about things that the working class in this country cares about. And I think too often the left distances themselves from average people and don't know how to speak their language, and we just come off sound like freaks instead of people who are actually not that different than... If you talk to the average person and for long enough, you'll find out that they don't like taxes, the government, the cops, they don't trust corporations. But, you know, what they might say is, well, what can you do about it anyways? Well, get to know them a little bit. Maybe you'll prove to them at some point that you can do a lot.
There's a fuck of a lot you can do about it.
True, right?
Now, we're getting on in time. And, Richard, you've come a long way to talk to us. And I know you did allude to Free Geek. And speaking of kind of putting action or putting your money where your mouth is, I'd like to hear a little bit about your experience with that and maybe the experience of being crazy enough to help to start a nonprofit in the trenches and you know, if you want to shed some light on.
Well, I'll give the real quick version of it, and I'll try to focus a little bit on what it's like to work there, because this is a worker show today. And we started in 2000, that's 8 years ago, and we decided what we wanted to do is look at a couple of these problems that we see. One problem we saw was a big divide technological divide between the poor and the rich, both worldwide but also in our own community. There are people who cannot afford to have the technology that they need in order to be able to, you know, get the most basic jobs these days.
We just got an Xbox in our house last week.
And then the digital divide being that one problem. And then the other problem was, while that one's going on, is that tons and tons and tons of poisonous electronic waste is being discarded every day because the planned obsolescence of the machines that people are buying. And we saw those two problems and stood back and kind of looked at them and said, well, to some degree, they can solve each other a little bit. And so we decided to start recycling all that stuff and that we could, and grab the good stuff and rebuild it and give that stuff away free to people who need it. And that's the essential piece of Free Geek. And when we created that concept, we set up a space we can work in, and we immediately formed a worker collective so that we would have control over our own workspace and our own working conditions. And we went about building a business model where we could pull in all this recycling material, refurbish it, and hand it out to people, and in the process teach people how to build those computers, help their education, help them help themselves, help them solve this or address this e-waste problem, but also address this digital divide problem, which is really much more of a problem of education than it is a problem of actually having stuff. And so we started that up in 2000 in Portland, Oregon, and there are now, I don't know how many Free Geeks there are, but
there's like 11.
There's like 11 of
11.
Us out there, at least trying some form or another. And Vancouver here is, you know, our wonderful baby sister organization, and we're happy to see you guys doing, in some ways, better than we are, and in some ways, you guys have a lot of interesting stuff to look forward to, let me tell you.
I'm glad that you also mentioned this idea of, you know, problems here and problems abroad. And I think a lot of what it comes down to is a solidarity issue, that there are terrible abuses being wrought upon citizens of all countries all over the place. And, you know, a lot of it does come down to economic lines, that those types of abuses are kind of inflicted upon the poor, and they can't protect themselves, and they can't stop toxic materials from entering their own community and from, you know, having to do toxic work, because a lot of people in poor nations have to work on computer electronics without much protection and without not only safety gear, but also environmental protections on a governmental level. And so a lot of the way that I look at it is, this is something that I can do here that not only benefits the people immediately right around me, but people that I've never met, that I don't know, that I'm helping to reduce the harm in their daily life in a very direct way.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the number one thing you can do is keep your computer, if you're using a computer, is keep your old one working somehow. Learn more about it. Keep it together. Don't give in to this, you know, have to get a new one every year mentality. And that right there impacts the environment in the most positive way and extends the life of the computer in the longest way and decreases e-waste that we're shipping overseas in the most dramatic way.
Do you think that people who are professionals in the technology industry have been traditionally less political or maybe more ambivalent to I'm seeing some head shaking. No, you think that they're radical?
No, not necessarily, but I don't think that you could characterize across the board that way. Long story short, there's a group called MAPS, which is an organization that does research about psychedelics, LSD, and mushrooms, and these kind of things. And the issue in the spring there they put out was psychedelics and technology, and almost every one of the big-time brains behind the internet and the computer age in the 60s were totally whacked on LSD. And I don't think that's behavior of right-wing people necessarily. I'm not saying that's the way all computer programmers are, but I think the history...
I mean, we're on LSD right now, but company included.
There is something to be said about the history of technology, that some of the best and biggest, most educated minds who now teach at Harvard University were people who in the 60s, while developing the idea of the internet, were whacked on acid going, yeah, everything's connected, man.
What about you, Richard? Do you have anything to say?
I'd say that, you know, from working with people in the technology industry, I'd say they're no more or less political than anybody else. They've got a wide range. I'd say there's maybe a, from my, you know, in my generation, I may be a little older than anybody else in this room. In my generation, I was noticing maybe more libertarians in that field. Than I would see in the rest of them. But, you know, the honest truth is that you got everybody. You got everybody in there. And a huge number. You know, I'm from, I don't know what it's like up here in Canada, north of the border, but below the 49th parallel, a lot of people are not political at all, and that's in every industry.
Yeah, certainly, eh?
Certainly, eh? What role do you guys think that technology can play in radicalizing people?
It's a means of communication, like the radio, you know, and I think that's its primary thing, you know. If we use it as a communication tool and we use it as an organizing tool, then yeah, it's a tool that can be of assistance. But going back to the IWW, we started in 1905, and not only was there no computers, there was, you know, very, you know, were there even telephones back then? There certainly wasn't a telephone system.
No.
There was telegraph.
Okay, so that's it, you know. But
people organized word of mouth.
You couldn't sign up and pay your dues online, let's put it that way. And in order to pay your dues, you probably had to hop a train and find a delegate, you know. Mm-hmm. And because of the, you know, huge size and space that, you know, we had to contend with back in those days. So it's the technology that we have now. It's not at all anything to fetishize. It's not anything, you know, that actually matters in the real thing, but it is there. It's a tool.
Sometimes I think that the most radicalizing effect technology will ever have is when the power finally goes out, mm-hmm. you know. And I think even seeing Toronto in 2003, the amazing acts that happened when the power went out, you would have thought the city would devolve into chaos, and that, frankly, without heavy-handed police presence, didn't happen. And the lights were out for days, and the whole city was in darkness. And sometimes I think the most radicalizing thing that could happen, I mean, technology is here, I have to use it. I'm an artist, a musician who has to spend hours a day planning my tours and my bookings online. It is useful to have the internet around, but also I look at the other side of it, that technology is doing more to suppress me than it is to free me, whether it's my own dependence on it or the right wing's capability, the people of power's capability to use technology to suppress us.
I see you jumping at the bit, Richard.
More music. I want more music.
We do have time for some more music. You guys should take us out. Maybe do you have another song up your sleeve?
Certainly.
Okay,
certainly.
Before you launch into that, I just want to say one thing. And as far as this idea of technology goes and the oppression or the taking charge of technology by individuals out there listening, I think a lot of people sometimes write it. I hear people write off technology and they say, oh, you know, I'm just an old Luddite, I'll never change. And I think sometimes what passes them by is that really it's a tool that you can use to multiply your efforts. And I think that is something that enables people without very much capital, without very much money, without a very loud voice, to really make connections with a whole bunch of other people very easily and at very low cost here in this country, or from a country where getting a computer is a relatively easy endeavor. I do want to say one thing about the Luddites, since this is a worker show, and the Luddites are very, very badly... I think they've been very misrepresented as far as what they were trying to achieve. Luddites really, a lot of, if you look them up on the internet, you're going to get a lot of people grumbling, but really the Luddites were all about quality in workmanship and workpersonship and taking back the means of production that had been taken away from them by automation. So they would do things like sabotage, which is also a tool of the IWW, to make their voices heard and be able to participate in reclaiming their labor, because they went from working in their homes at hours that they chose and making items of really great craftsmanship to actually having to go to a factory, work in unsafe conditions, work set hours, and for not very much money in the end. So I think we should always think about the Luddites as people who really have this idea of not being alienated from your own labor and being having a humane work environment and a fun work environment.
I'll never discount an avenue that you have at your... that's available to you. Mm-hmm. Whether I'm crazy about computers or not, I'm probably not, but I would never discount the fact that they're entirely useful for what I have to do.
Mm-hmm. Use everything.
It'd be irrelevant it'd be redundant to me to be against technology. If we've only got a few minutes left, we've been talking about solidarity a lot. There is an old song that first appeared in the 9th edition of the Industrial Workers of the World's Little Red Songbook, and it was a song called Aristocracy Forever. Solidarity Forever. I'm getting ahead of myself. But my experience as a radical has been that the union movement is not particularly knowledgeable in solidarity or very good at practicing it. The first big taste of that I had was in the year 2001. We were organizing against Mike Harris in Ontario, and we had all the unions sign on, and we're going to have this big shutdown of Toronto and screw Harris over, except when September 11th happened, suddenly all the union movements, Buzz Hargrove from CAW, our big supporters, pulled the funding, pulled the guts out from beneath us, and then when we went to do our final march, it was 3,500 of us against a 1,500 mounted strong police force with tear gas and armor and no union support. And so Judy Barry's version, Aristocracy Forever, I tend to like better. It's more truthful. Judy Barry was a great union organizer who was an IWW member and an Earth First member who was the first to actually see that loggers' concerns and working class concerns and environmental concerns were actually in the same boat. She said, workers, you got to organize because they're making you clear the whole forest down and you're not going to have work in 10 years at this rate. And they're raping it all and you're not getting shit. And she was a very good organizer and eventually got bombed by the FBI and died a little bit later. But she sung Aristocracy Forever. It goes like this.
When the union leaders pay off by the bosses has begun, there will be no labor trouble anywhere beneath the sun. For the AFL trade unions and the management are one, and the union keeps us down. Aristocracy forever, aristocracy forever, aristocracy forever, the union keeps us down. It's we who have to suffer through the daily drudgery. Well, Sinclair pulls $100,000 salary. He claims to lead the workers, he's just a bourgeoisie, and the union keeps us down. Everybody! Aristocracy forever, aristocracy forever, the union keeps us down. What do workers hold in common with the labor bureaucrat, who's a class collaborationist and a boss's diplomat? With the money from our paychecks, he is sitting getting fat. Well, the union keeps us down. Next verse. They aligned us with the mafia, the CIA, and more, serving counter-revolution and oppression of the poor. So the union doesn't represent our interests anymore. The union keeps us down. Aristocracy forever. Aristocracy forever. Aristocracy forever. The union keeps us down. At our hands we hold a power they don't even know about. They've forgotten that the workers are the union's source of clout. When the rank and file workers kick the union bosses out, again we will be strong. Solidarity, solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Again we will be strong. Again we will be strong. Again we will be strong.
You've been listening to the Pedal Revolutionary Show. Thanks to all the Pedal Revolutionaries and even the guilty multiple transport. Don't worry. You know what? It was mass transport when you were going across the country, and you probably did more harm than good. You burned up in fossil fuels. I say don't worry about it. We give you a carbon tax official from the Pedal Revolutionary. What's that?
You mean more good than harm?
You did. Oh, did I say the opposite?
The opposite.
Yes, that was my bad side speaking. Well, you know what? You did more bad to the bosses.
My liver, we did more harm than good.
And you did more bad to the bosses than good. So thank you again. Thank you all, gentlemen, for all of the great work that you do. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. You've been listening to 101.9 FM CITR, and we're going to go out with a song called Computer Show by Adam Green.
Oh, I stumbled in all wide-eyed to the computer show. I didn't have a passport, so they turned me into snow. They turned me into snow.
follow you, follow you, follow you, follow you into every store. Follow you, follow you, follow you, follow you, tell me what I'm for. Tell me what I'm for. I stumbled in all wide-eyed to the computer show. I didn't have my passport, so they turned me into snow. They turned me into snow. Follow you, follow you, follow you, follow you into every store. Follow you, follow you, follow you, follow you, tell me what I'm for. You caught my eye against your eye deep inside the crowd. You hung me from the hooks inside my asshole and my mouth. My asshole and my mouth. Follow you, follow you, follow you, follow you into every store. Follow you, follow you, follow you, tell me what I'm for. Tell me what I'm for. Computer show. I didn't have my passport, so they turned me into snow.
No.
They turned me into snow.
No.
They turned me into snow.
No.